Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Since Smart Talk debuted 10 years ago this week, there are certain topics and issues that you tell us you're interested in and find important and compelling. Among those topics are the environment and environmental issues. On today's program, we look back and ahead when it comes to Pennsylvania's environment. Joining us today is David Hess, former Pennsylvania Secretary of the Department of Environmental Protection and a lobbyist for Creasy Associates. Secretary Hess, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Congratulations on your 10 years.
Well, thank you very much. Also, former Senator Franklin Curry, author of the Environmental Amendment in Pennsylvania's Constitution, a lobbyist and a board emeritus of the Pennsylvania Environmental Council. Senator Curry, welcome back to the show.
Happy birthday.
Thank you very much. If you have a question or a comment about Pennsylvania's environment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Senator Curry, I'm going to start with you. Pennsylvania's environment over the last 10 years, I mean, you have been a pioneer in the environmental movement here in Pennsylvania. How do you see, and by the way, I should add, how you define the environment in Pennsylvania, but how do you see the state's environment over the past decade?
Well, by the environment, we mean the natural environment, the air, the land, the water, and so forth. And I think it's improved. There's still a problem area, certainly. But I think a couple of things happened in the last 10 years that have really helped the environment. And they came from the Supreme Court. In 2013, the Supreme Court ruled in the case involving the Oil and Natural Gas Act, that the Article 1, Section 27, the Environmental Amendment, had real meaning. For 40 years, the court slept on it and didn't read it. Then Justice Castile and a majority of the court said, we are going to read the King's English, the American English in that amendment, and we're going to interpret it the way it means. And they threw out two sections of the oil and gas law.
Before we go any further, tell our listeners, if they're not familiar, what the amendment says.
Well, what the amendment says is the people of Pennsylvania have a right to a decent environment, you know, clean air, pure water, and so on. And the public natural resources of the state are the common property of all the people. And the third clause in the amendment says that the state of Pennsylvania shall serve as trustee of these resources for future generations. So as I said, for 40 years, the courts pretty much ignored it. But then Justice Castile and three or four others came along with the case, and they put real meaning into it. Then 2 years later, in the Environmental Defense Fund case, they added further to it. So I think this has brought about a lot more litigation, but what it means is there are people out there who are going to court to protect the environment. Now, how those cases come out varies from case to case, but that's a great step forward, to my mind, in protecting the environment.
Secretary Hess, how do you see the environment over the past 10 years?
Well, as you said, it could be a very broad thing. We've done a good job getting sort of the big chunks out of the air, the big chunks out of the water, and that progress continues. But following up on what Senator Curry said, the thing that triggered those court cases was the one thing that had the biggest impact on the environment, the economy, and frankly, the budget of Pennsylvania since your show began to air in 2008, and that's Marcellus Shale natural gas development. You know, back in 2008 when your show started, oil and gas was a sleepy little program in DEP. Now it's the biggest program they have. We now have over 11,500 Marcellus Shale wells, along with thousands of miles of pipeline, all the jobs that go along with that. But one of the things that, you know, was related to that was the fact that it wasn't until 2013 that we had a comprehensive state law to regulate these kinds of complicated oil and gas operations. And interpreting that law was how we got the two Supreme Court cases. The first one saying that the Environmental Rights Amendment is something that local and state government needs to enforce. The second one reinforcing the notion that governments of all levels have a responsibility as trustee of the environment to see that the environment was protected. So if it wasn't for the oil and gas development, we wouldn't have those decisions.
I'd like to point out, David, that when we wrote the amendment back in 1969-70, nobody ever heard of Marcellus Shale. Yeah. They had any idea it was out there. The amendment was written broadly for whatever might come up in the future. And, of course, Marcellus Shale is a big thing that's come up. So,
yeah. Well, that's okay. That is the big thing that has come up in the past decade here in Pennsylvania, and it's had an impact in a lot of ways.
Right.
But, Secretary Hess, what impact has Marcellus Shale horizontal fracking had on the environment here in Pennsylvania?
If you just look at the environmental impact, when it started, you had spills. You had improperly constructed wells. One of the most famous cases was Dimmick in Susquehanna
right.
County,
right.
where they caused water wells within a 9-square-mile area to be contaminated because methane got into those water wells. You had a lot of those sort of problems because what DEP was trying to do was basically create a regulatory program on the fly as this was happening out there.
It was happening too fast.
It was happening very fast. I mean, and the scale of this is, I think, almost unbelievable because you had landowners leasing their land. You had the first exploratory well developed in 2003. But 2008, again, when your program started, was when it started to ramp up. And now we have, as I said, over 11,500 wells. And the impact of that, though, goes far beyond that. I mean, natural gas production in this state increased 2,800% since 2008. That has had all sorts of ripple impacts as well. On the environment, we have seen a significant decrease in greenhouse gas emissions because that gas came into the market. It was lower priced than coal. 1/3 of Pennsylvania's coal-fired power plants have closed because of natural gas, and the resulting emissions have ceased because natural gas is a much cleaner fuel. So there's been tremendous impact, positive impacts like that happening as a result of natural gas and its impact on the environment.
Senator Curry, your thoughts on the impact of gas drilling, natural gas here in Pennsylvania over the past 10 years?
Well, I will yield to David on that. He's much closer to that than I am. I would just say this about the gas industry. We didn't have any idea it was going to happen when we passed the amendment. But one of the reasons we passed the amendment because of what the coal industry had done to Pennsylvania in the 100 years preceding it. Now, whatever you think of natural gas, it is not the coal industry all over again, because the coal industry didn't have to do anything. They just did what they wanted, and the state supported them. But the gas industry, if they want to do, they've got to file applications with the DEP. They've got to put up bonds. They've got to go through inspection. There's a lot of enforcement. None of that applied to the coal companies. Now, I don't know whether the state's doing it right or wrong. There probably need for strengthening the regulations, but the basic idea that this is a regulated industry, it's not like the coal industry at all. So I just wanted to point that out.
Secretary Hess, you were the Secretary of the Department of Environmental Protection. One of the criticisms of, not necessarily the injury of the industry, but of how it has been regulated, natural gas drilling in Pennsylvania, is that DEP, and you kind of touched on this earlier, that it happened so fast that DEP couldn't keep up, that there are not enough inspectors of wells, and as a result, the potential for some of those leaks you talked about or spills that you talked about. Fortunately, there haven't been a lot of them. Now, I know some people say, well, what do you call a lot? But again, one of the criticisms has been that DEP has not kept up with the number of inspectors. What do you think?
I think they're in a much better position today than they were, obviously, in 2008. You know, in 2008, they may have had a couple dozen people to do permitting and inspections, and that's it. Now they have over 190, okay, supported by fees. Back then in 2008, a permit well fee, even for Marcellus, was $100. Now DEP is proposing to increase that with the latest round of fee increases to over $12,000 to support a robust regulatory program. And I think we're the department has learned. It had to learn on the fly. They are in a much better position today than they are, and they're always learning. And I think that's the key. So I'm pretty optimistic that they have a much, much better handle on this initiative going forward if they get the continued appropriate financial support to continue that robust regulatory program.
We're going to talk more about this in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. 10th anniversary week this week on Smart Talk. We're talking about one of the topics that you are most interested in and have been over the years, and that is Pennsylvania's environment. Joining us today, former Senator Franklin Curry, author of the Environmental Amendment in Pennsylvania's Constitution. He's also an author. I don't know. I have so many different things I could describe you as. I'll stop with author for now during this part of the program. David Hess, former Secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection and a lobbyist for Creasy Associates. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk, WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And we're going to take some calls in just a moment. But, Senator, you wanted to follow up with what David Hess said just a moment ago.
Yes, I think the legislature has to bear a good share of the responsibility for inadequate or less than adequate regulation because they have short funded the department over the last few years. They've cut back. And when they got more money in the environmental fund, which came out of the fees for the for the drilling on state lands, that exploded. As David says, that exploded. It was a sleepy little fund, and suddenly they got millions of dollars. Well, the legislature tried to divert that. It was supposed to be used only for environmental purposes, but the legislature tried to divert that money for the balance of the general fund budget. And that was the case that John Childs took to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled they couldn't do it. And I don't think enough legislators take seriously their obligation to carry out the state constitution as it applies to Article 1, Section 27. And that's why they've tried to use environmental funds to balance the budget. And I think that is just a bad mark on the state legislature.
All right, let's take a phone call. Let's see. We have on the line now, I just want to make sure we have the right person. Heather is in Lititz. Heather, you're on the air.
Hi, I was down fishing this past weekend, and a lot of people don't know there's a ton of waterways that go in between the city blocks, like off of Cameron Street. There was such a huge amount of waste, it was disgusting. You know, where I'm from, if you have a company that has a waterway behind their building, they're responsible for making sure that waterway is clear. Like, there's solid human waste in that Susquehanna River. If you go farther up the river, it clears up immediately. And we really need to hold the city accountable for making sure that that water is clean. Every time it rains, solid waste is going into the river. We caught 20 fish. We had to throw them all back. I wouldn't eat anything that came out of that river.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. You see, the thing I like about her call is that it shows, okay, we were talking about natural gas drilling and how big of an issue, but just something as simple as someone dropping a line into the Susquehanna River or one of the tributary to the river, any waterway here in Pennsylvania, that's what people care about and why it is so important. Now, one thing I will say, and I'll ask the two of you, obviously, we have had a lot of rain this year, and I wonder whether that has contributed to the amount of trash, as she described it, has washed its way down the river, or is the river really that unhealthy that, you know, I know there have been times where there have been warnings, don't eat the fish out of the Susquehanna. What do you think?
Well, I think a couple of things. In Pennsylvania right now, just to start at the top level, there are 19, almost 20,000 miles of streams that have impaired water quality, which means they're not good for drinking or fishing or swimming in. And that represents a huge challenge. Along the Susquehanna, we have the additional challenge of reducing pollution that comes off the land and from wastewater plants because of our obligation to clean up the Chesapeake Bay, and that remains a huge challenge. I mean, one of the things that's happened is that the General Assembly, as Senator Curry had mentioned, has cut back by 75% the funding for projects, green infrastructure projects, to cure some of those problems since 2008, when your show started. And, you know, that is not helping. And we have to find a way to get more projects on the ground. So there, as I said, there's still lots of problems out there, but having green natural solutions such as floodplain restoration to give water a place to go before it goes downstream, passive treatment systems out west to treat acid mine drainage before it gets into streams. You know, mm-hmm. as secretary, I had the privilege of going to each and every county in Pennsylvania 2.5 times. And I got to see a lot of these projects out there. People really care. And the most emotional people were the ones that came up to me and said, you know, without this project funded by Growing Greener, that's been now cut 75%, I couldn't have taken my granddaughter fishing in that stream without this project and this state support. We've got to get back to that.
Well, I want to ask, so in response to what the lady who from Linden said about the heavy rains, one of the places the state legislature needs to work is to put more teeth into the stormwater management bill. Because when you get all this rain, it causes great flash flooding. It covers a lot more ground, and it sweeps a lot more of this waste into the waterway. Now, we passed that bill in 1978. It's only been partially implemented. And I would like to see the legislature do a series of hearings on that bill or that law and see what they can do to strengthen it, to make people hold back the water so as it comes out as flash floods.
We have an email here from Scott. It says, the American Lung Association regularly ranks southeastern Pennsylvania as having some of the worst air quality in the country. What can be done by the Pennsylvania legislature to improve the air quality and ultimately the health of the residents of Pennsylvania? Senator Curry, I'll go to you on that one.
I think I would defer to David. He knows more about that subject than I do. I don't know what the issue is in southeastern Pennsylvania. I'm just not familiar with it.
Well, it's ozone pollution. It's those hot summer days when you get pollution in the air and fine particulate matter.
Yeah, the particles, right.
But the one thing you have to keep a little context, when your show started in 2008, there were 17 counties in Pennsylvania that didn't comply with the federal ozone pollution standard. That is now down to 5 counties. And those are in the southeast, okay. The more urbanized areas. So we've seen a lot of improvement. Again, because of new regulations going into effect to cover major sources and the shift from coal to natural gas as a way of generating electricity. So, again, a lot of progress. But we're way short of being done with this.
Senator Curry, and I want to move on to some other issues. Climate change, obviously, is a major concern. The Trump administration is pulling, they haven't officially done it yet, but pulled the United States out of the Paris Accords. Yeah. What can a state, now the Wolf administration has taken some steps, other states across the country have taken some steps that would comply with the Paris Agreement. But what can a state do to try to reduce the effects of climate change or slow it down, at least?
Well, I think one of the first things a state can do is adopt the position that Article 1, Section 27 covers climate change, because that's what we're trying to protect. Now, what they can do, I would think, has to do with the regulation of what is emitted into the air. How much carbon dioxide will you let into the air? These things can be toughened. Car emissions, all these things, we've got to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide. The state can do a great deal there.
But is there the political will to do that?
Well, that's a different question, as I said.
I know it's a big question.
I don't think enough state legislators take Article 1, Section 27 seriously as part of their oath. And I would urge all our listeners to talk to your candidates for the House and Senate this fall and ask them where they stand on it.
Mm-hmm. Secretary Hess?
I think there's a lot of things that states can do, because they're not hemmed in by what the federal government says or doesn't say. Like I said, I mean, sort of by accident, this transition of getting away from coal to natural gas has resulted in tremendous greenhouse gas emission reduction. So that's sort of happened without anybody doing anything, and because of the energy market itself. But they're right now, DEP is going through an update of their climate action plan. They're going to be recommending additional measures, whether it's more energy efficiency, different vehicle emission standards, as the senator said, a whole menu of things that can be accomplished. They recently put out a new permit covering oil and gas operation emissions of methane, which is a huge greenhouse gas. So states can certainly do a lot. The executive can certainly do a lot. The governor, whoever it might be, come after November.
When you say a lot.
And the General Assembly.
But when you say a lot, Pennsylvania is one state. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a worldwide problem.
Sure.
Would it make a difference if Pennsylvania and, say, 20 other states, 25 other states, do something like Pennsylvania?
Oh, sure it would.
Why do you say that?
Well, because it all counts. I mean, it's not the full bag, but it's half a loaf is better than none. And I think what the Trump administration has done here in walking away from this is just incredible. It's stupid. Every scientist in the world, just so to speak, believes in this process. The UN just came out with a warning last week, and the Trump people keep their eyes closed on it. I just can't get over that. It's just
nuts. The warning that you're talking about, and we're going to talk about that in this program here in the near future, was that basically we have 11 years before the climate changes to a point where it will be dangerous, and we maybe can't come back from that. Have the two of you in your, traveling around Pennsylvania or talking to people in environmental circles? I don't know if there is such a thing. have we seen the impacts of climate change in Pennsylvania already?
Oh, sure. I don't think there's any.
Like in what ways?
Any doubt about that. I think in a couple different ways. I mean, we had a study that came out last year by Center for Rural Pennsylvania. Over the last 50 years, the number of very heavy precipitation events that have happened, and anybody that was around the state this summer knows what heavy precipitation.
Can I say I'm sick of this humidity too?
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is that they did an analysis over the last 50 years. The number of those incidents have increased in Pennsylvania 71%, and that they attribute to climate change, but we're seeing other kinds of impacts as well. You see invasive species that are growing and becoming more of a threat in Pennsylvania. We used to be concerned about gypsy moss. Everybody remembers that from the 1970s.
It's a shame that the gypsy moth is antique.
Yeah, I mean, but now we have the woolly algid. We have, of course, West Nile virus, something that wasn't around in Pennsylvania, before it was sort of discovered in 2000. We have, the emerald ash borer, again, an Asian import. That threat has increased, and we have a number of other.
Well, the lanternfly is the latest. Yeah.
The lanternfly is the latest pest. Some call it a pest, but it's a real threat to agriculture. And the changing environment as a result of climate over the years. For example, the Senate Ag Committee here in Pennsylvania had a hearing. Non-native, and invasive species of plants are, according to that hearing, ecologically castrating is the term that the professor used, Pennsylvania's landscape. So there are fewer insects, fewer caterpillars, fewer birds, fewer other wildlife that depend on them. They hit pollinators that are critical to agriculture, their populations are going down. These are all kinds of things that we're seeing as symptoms of climate change beginning to happen. And they're more are there if you look.
We have a couple emails here from listeners. I live in Mannheim, very rural, agricultural. Board of Supervisors have leaned to keep it that way. Our environment belongs to all of us, not just the wealthy or the farm owners. The soil is in the top 5%. We are paving paradise to put up a parking lot. I think he's... Carol, quoting Joni Mitchell. We need agritourism, not development in this case. What do you think? And I think my follow-up question to that is one of the big issues in the state is preserving farmland, preserving forest land, preservation overall.
Yeah, well, that is basically up to each local area what they're going to do. And if they want to do that, I think that's wonderful. And I think the whole idea of turning cornfields or agricultural fields into parking lot raises a lot of questions. That's one of the reasons you get so much stormwater runoff. If you have a cornfield of 100 acres and it rains, that's like a huge sponge that accepts the water and it slowly drips out. You make a parking lot out of it as like a turtle shell. It runs off quickly and flash flooding.
Senator, where am I going to park, though?
Well, they have to make a balancer.
If you keep building, where do you put cars?
Well, they have to figure that out, but they got to understand what the trade-offs are.
Yeah, I'm pushing back just because I know there will be developers that ask that question.
If they're willing to do that, they ought to put up stormwater management facilities. Mm-hmm. Like in the development where my wife and I live, a few hundred yards away, there's a large swale next to the path, and that's a stormwater runoff container. And that's what developers have to be required to do. If they want to take away from the absorption of the land, then they should be able to hold that water back so it goes off slowly and not in a flash.
You know, this is one of our 10th anniversary programs, and we're going to have this discussion a little bit more because I see we're getting a lot of emails and questions here, and there are so many issues to cover that we didn't get to. But I promise that at the beginning of the program, this is an issue where we have to talk about the future. Senator, what about the future of Pennsylvania's environment? What has to happen to make it even better?
Well, I think two things have got to happen. One is the legislature has got to take more seriously its oath to uphold Article 1, Section 27 of the Constitution. They've got to put full funding into the department for these enforcement programs and regulation programs. That's critical. The laws are no good if there's nobody out there to enforce them. The second thing is they've got to accept the fact that they have a responsibility to deal with climate change through the regulation of carbon emissions in the environment. Those are the two big things I think they need to do.
Secretary Hess.
Well, I'm optimistic about the future because we have to educate our legislators that these kinds of natural systems, whether it's farmland or, as the senator said, stormwater retention areas or floodplain restoration, recreation, all these things have value. And people are starting to now document that through the Kittatinny Ridge Project.
Which we mentioned, talked about yesterday. Yeah,
They have completed studies that show that these kinds of green infrastructure and natural environmental services have a dollar value. They actually did a return on investment. And they found that in the first eight or so counties that they completed, it's worth over $1 billion. So they use that as a tool to target investment, saying if you invest X, you can expect a return, an economic return of Y. And with the development of those kind of tools, I think we can do a better job of convincing some of the decision makers in the General Assembly that this stuff does have more than sort of it looks nice kind of value. Mm. It has real flood control benefits and the rest.
I want to thank our guest today, David Hess, former Secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection and a lobbyist for Creasy Associates, and former Senator Franklin Curry, the author of the Environmental Amendment in Pennsylvania's Constitution. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, and happy birthday again.
Well, thank you. And I also wanted to mention that there's a documentary coming up on WITF-TV. Secretary Hess is involved in that. It's called Generations Yet to Come, Environmental Rights in Pennsylvania. It is scheduled to air on WITF-TV 8 p.m. Thursday, October 25th. So be sure to tune in for that. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, battling the flu. It is forecast to be a bad flu season, and we'll talk about flu shots, why they're so important this year. The restored mammal exhibit at the State Museum and the Harrisburg Book Festival. Those are all topics we discuss on tomorrow's program. As we get back to Smart Talk, we continue our conversations with the candidates appearing on the November election ballot. Joining us today is Denny Wolf, Democratic candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 9th Congressional District. The 9th Congressional District is made up of Lebanon, Schuylkill, Columbia, and parts of Berks, Carbon, Northumberland, Luzerne, and Montour counties. Secretary Wolf, welcome to the program.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Secretary Wolf, former Secretary of the Department of Agriculture. We have a lot of former cabinet secretaries here today, but thank you for being with us. You were with us before the primary. Now we know who your opponent is in the 9th Congressional District. You're running against Dan Mueser. For those who may not be familiar with this, is a big district, and even though you were a statewide cabinet secretary, there may be those who don't know a whole lot about Denny Wolf. Tell us about it.
Well, sure. I'm a dairy farmer. My farm is in Columbia County. Our farm is just north of Bloomsburg in a small town of Millville. So I'm the third generation to farm the farms that are known as Penn Coal Farms. So our farm not only produced milk, but we also provided genetics around the globe. We had registered Holsteins, still have registered Holsteins, and we export frozen embryos and cattle to pretty much every continent.
So why are you running?
Well, I'm running because I think Congress desperately needs some people from the real world. And when I started to consider running and I talked to my friends and my neighbors, they really encouraged me because they said the last thing we need in Congress is another stuffed suit, someone that's going to represent the wealthy, someone that's going to represent the powerful. We need someone in Congress that can represent the working families of the Ninth. And a farmer, of course, knows how to work and is blessed with common sense and has business skills that he develops over the years, or he wouldn't be in business.
So what do you see as the most important issues facing the nation and also the 9th Congressional District?
Well, when I meet with people in the 9th, a couple of things easily float right to the top. Health care costs are number one. And then number two would be the concern of our senior citizens in making sure that Social Security and Medicare is funded in the future. Those two easily become the two big issues when I do a roundtable or meet with people in different communities.
When you talk about health care, and you said health care cost, there are more aspects to health care than just the cost. Yes, we know it is very expensive. Access is also a big part of it. The Affordable Care Act that was enacted during the Obama administration has become a big issue in itself, always has been since the very beginning. So what has happened under the ACA is a lot more people are insured. A lot of Republicans say that, it was not the best way. It was government intrusion. What are your thoughts on how people should be insured in this country? What's government's role in that?
Well, I think when you look at the healthcare system, whether it's the providers or the people that are insured, a couple things are easy to identify. It costs the United States $3.2 trillion a year, and it is a huge part of our GDP. It is like almost 18% of our GDP. That is twice as much as any developed country in the world. That's a problem. So it's easy to identify that and put your finger on it. So then you need to start looking at how we're going to solve that problem. The Affordable Care Act basically looked at and dealt with the problem by making dollars available for people that couldn't pay for their health insurance. They really did not look at and or try to get involved with the cost side of that ledger. I think that needs to happen. I think when you look at an organization, the one I like to use is Duke Medical Center. They have 900 doctors and 1,300 billing clerks. That tells you there's something wrong. The hospitals need to standardize their billing systems. The insurance companies need to standardize their coverage. So people know what a level playing field is. They need to know what their copay is going to be, what their out-of-pocket expenses are going to be. So I think the focus needs to be there, specifically on the healthcare delivery system, as well as prescription drugs are out of control. You know, they have increased substantially more than the average inflation rate, like 10 times more. So we've got costs that are running away, and those costs that are running away are costing the rank and file of people in the 9th Congressional District, and in most cases working families, phenomenal amounts of money, and that gives them a lot of challenges in managing a budget and raising their families there.
So when you're talking about standardizing care, standardizing a lot of the administrative stuff, hospitals standardizing, what does that mean? I mean, because let's face it, it is a private industry, and it's no secret that you can go from one provider to another for the same procedure, and it will cost thousands of dollars more here than it would at the other. So what do you mean by standardizing it?
Well, I think standardizing it from the standpoint of different procedures that are available. You know, what are they? You know, identify them, make them uniform between different hospitals.
Same cost are you talking about?
Well, the cost can be different. I'm not talking about the, I'm just talking about standardize it. You know, the way that a hospital in Danville may bill differently than a hospital in Camp Hill, for example. So there needs to be some kind of standardization there so consumers know what they're getting. It adds transparency to the process. If you go in a hospital and say, I sprained my wrist, I need to have an x-ray, what will you charge me? They don't know what to charge you because it's it said, well, what kind of insurance do you have? And then you start the process of backing into that and seeing what your out-of-pocket may or may not be. That's foolish. And when you look at 900 doctors and 1,300 billing clerks at Duke University Medical Center, that adds around 15% to your hospital bill, the administrative costs alone.
So you've identified the problem, but what is government's role in that?
Well, the government's role is to step in there and put in place some kind of a structure for them and suggest that they follow that. I mean, the government certainly has some ability there. Currently, we have Medicare and Medicaid that the government obviously is in charge of and administers, so that's a starting point. You know, you can look at how that is done and how that system, that's a pretty big club to hold over the healthcare delivery system. And they will pay attention if the government steps in and says, this is a problem, you need to clean it up, or we'll clean it up for you.
Many of the Democratic candidates for Congress that I've spoken to this year support Medicare for all, that universal health care, one-payer system, however you want to describe it or call it. Do you support that?
I like to say that that's down the list, maybe second or third. I think that, that's an option that we may have to look at in the future. But I would really like to see a private enterprise come forward and help solve this problem through competitiveness and some uniformity and streamlining of the way the system works. I think we have an opportunity to do that. Let's take a shot at that and see if we can make it happen.
Even though you say that's down on the list, and I want to bring in, as I said, you now have a Republican opponent in the election, Dan Muser. I've seen his television commercials where he says that you are a liberal, you were born a liberal, and you've always been a liberal. I tie that into healthcare because, as I said, that it is something that is associated with progressive candidates. What do you say to that?
Well, look, I've never seen a dairy farmer that's a liberal yet. I mean, we know what it's like to work 7 days a week. In my situation, I raised five kids on a dairy farm and worked hard 7 days a week to send them all to college. So I know the value of a dollar. I know what sweat equity is. So I know what the people in rural Pennsylvania are dealing with and what their lives are like day to day. So I am anything but a liberal. I'm a person that's been given an A grade by the NRA. How many Democrats have received that? You know, I am a Democrat that stepped forward from day one saying that I can't support Nancy Pelosi because we desperately need new leadership in Congress. That's just a couple of the examples of what makes me different from the standpoint of some of the Democratic candidates. And it's basically listening to the people of the 9th Congressional District and wanting to be their representing and wanting to be their voice at the table.
You just mentioned that you get an A grading from the NRA. There aren't many Democrats who would tout that as an accomplishment. You are running in a district that is rural. There are a lot of hunters. There are a lot of gun owners in that area. But obviously, we have had too much gun violence in this country, whether it be at schools, other public places, the number of murders that are committed on the streets in the areas of this state, this country, I should say. So do you support any kind of changes in our gun laws today?
I support enforcing the rules that we have on the books today and enforcing them in a way that keeps the guns out of the hands of people that are mentally ill, out of the hands of people that have a criminal record, and out of the hands of people with a PFA against them. If you can accomplish that and put in an accurate and efficient and effective system to identify those people and make sure they don't have access to guns, you've solved the bulk of the problem right there.
So are you talking about universal background checks?
Well, I'm talking about the background checks that we have today and making sure
Okay, so you wouldn't expand that?
Today, no. Let's see if we put the current system that we have in place, make sure that it is working, make sure that we're using the newest technology, the latest technology to improve that, and see where that puts us today.
You also support increasing the minimum wage. To what, over what period of time?
Well, if you do the simple math on that and look at what the wages were in the 1970s and just change the value of the dollar today, the minimum wage becomes $10.75 an hour. And I think that's reasonable. That's not really changing anything. That's the dollar from the 70s to the dollar in 2018. So let's do that, take a look at it. We don't want to put anyone out of business, but we need to have a minimum wage that's up to date and current.
You know, and you, of course, you know, are familiar with the arguments against that. And there are many small businesses in the 9th Congressional District that small businesses, employers say, you do it that quickly, you increase it to $15 an hour, whatever, that they won't hire as many people.
Well, unfortunately, this system should be on some kind of a structure where the value of the dollar is considered every year so that we don't have to get through this and it doesn't become a political football. I mean, the minimum wage is in place for a reason. We have a lot of working families in the 9th Congressional District. We also have a lot of small businesses. I understand that there is a difference of opinion there, but I think in all fairness, if you look at what the wages were in the 70s and bring that into the 2018, I think that makes sense. It's just common sense from what it was then till what it is now with the change in the value of the dollar.
You mentioned earlier that the two issues that you hear most often about health care costs, but also Medicare, and I assume Social Security is lumped with that when your would-be constituents talk about it. So what is your plan or what do you support to continue Medicare as we know it? I don't know. I hesitate in saying saving Medicare, but Medicare as we know it, maybe expand it, what?
Well, first off on Medicare, I think that Medicare should be able to negotiate prescription drugs just like Medicaid and the VA system does. That would be a step in the right direction. That would save billions of dollars over the course of the next 5 years. And then certainly from the standpoint of Social Security, the cap is around $128,000 right now of wages that qualify for Social Security payroll deduction. That needs to be increased. The right number, probably $350,000, maybe $400,000. That puts the Social Security system back on track to be solvent for years to come.
Are you concerned that it is not solvent now?
I am not. If you look at the basic numbers and the amount of money that's in the reserve fund, and what the money going into that is. It is solvent today. And the best estimate is 2034. That could change. That's when the reserve fund would be depleted, and then Social Security payments would decrease. So we need to make sure that our fund is fully funded and healthy so that $90 billion a year that is generated from interest from the Social Security surplus fund continues to be part of the disbursements.
We are going, and I'm jumping around on you, but trying to get to as many issues as possible. We live in a polarized country right now. And the last 3 weeks, 2 weeks especially, with the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court has probably provided the best example of that in a long, long time. If you are elected to Congress, what do you think about working across the aisle? How do we do something to reduce this polarization? How do we get government working again? Because there are many people who feel that it doesn't work, that it's all political in nature.
Well, I had a lot of practice at that. When I was Ed Rendell's Secretary of Agriculture, I represented him in rural issues and on farms across the Commonwealth. That's a very conservative part of our population, by far the majority being Republicans. Never had a problem with that. It's all about identifying important issues, looking at public policy from the standpoint of whether it's worthy of consideration or not, and moving it forward, whether it's introduced by a Republican or a Democrat.
But party leadership is so strong, in the U.S. House of Representatives, the U.S. Senate, even here on the state level, you've experienced that, I'm sure. How do you buck your party leadership? How do you run for Congress and not think about re-election?
Well, that's not something I think about. I mean, maybe that's the advantage of being 67 years old and running for public office. You're worried about representing the people in the 9th Congressional District for 2 years or 6 years or 8 years. I think there should be term limits. I don't think someone should be there and make a career out of it. So I am not worried about leadership. I'm simply worried about the people in the 9th Congressional District, and every 2 years they have the opportunity to go in the voting booth and decide whether I've done a good job or not.
Term limits, how long?
8 years.
8 years. That's a little bit shorter than what most. Most would say 12.
Well, when I was Secretary of Agriculture, I know that when I was in there for 6, 7 years, you know, it was, I think you kind of lose the fresh ideas and kind of the fire in the belly and, you know, your ideas have been implemented. I think that that makes, for me, it made perfect sense to step out of that role at that point in my career. And I think that just like in Pennsylvania, where you have a 4-year cycle for the for a governor with a two-term limit, 8 years makes sense. That you can make a significant difference in that period of time, but you don't become entrenched and really make it a career.
And again, I am jumping around issues, and I think about some of the things that we spoke about in the primary season back in the spring. You have vowed to try to make a post-secondary education more affordable. In what way?
Well, certainly making sure that all of the programs that are in place continue to be there, whether it's the Pell Grant, whether it's a loan forgiveness program, whether it's a work study program, that they are fully funded and available to the different colleges and universities, students that are attending colleges and universities. I think one of the other parts of that really should be looked at, and I experienced this when I was on the Board of Trustees at Penn State, I think the colleges need to be accountable for their spending, too. You know, sometimes their spending habits way exceed what inflation is. So as these grants and low-interest loans are available, unfortunately, they're gobbled up by increased college costs, whether it's tuition, books, or fees, or room and board. So I think there's two sides to this, just like there is to any discussion. There is the cost of the education, and then there is the people that are providing it, making sure that they're not overstepping their boundaries and making something unaffordable.
But how do you, again, how does government control that? Because even if the grants that you've talked about, that there have been some reductions in some of those areas from the federal government, but even if they stayed the same right now, tuitions increase every year. You know, I don't have the figure at the top of my head about how tuitions have increased past the rate of inflation, many times past that. And even though most students, well over 90%, get some type of financial aid, it still is very affordable. The sticker shock for some students, they don't even consider it from some areas that, you know, come from, maybe don't, the family doesn't have a whole lot of money, maybe living in poverty. Student doesn't even consider it because they think there's no way I can afford that.
Well, there's no question that there's different cost levels at college. In other words, if you're going to send your child to Harvard or you're going to send them to Bloomsburg University, there's a significant difference in the cost of the education, and that's certainly something that families look at and determine. But I think the bottom line is it needs to be affordable for all students, and we need to level the playing field by making sure that we have fully funded Pell Grants and that we have fully funded the Work Study Program and that we have fully funded the low-interest loans and the loan forgiveness programs are in place for students that can take advantage of that to make their education affordable so that they can go to college and achieve a degree and earn additional income when they graduate and be able to come into society and not be overburdened by the cost of their education.
I don't know whether the federal government's going to have a whole lot to say about this issue, especially if it goes back to the states, but part of the whole the controversy over was whether more conservative justices would vote certain ways on certain issues. Abortion was one of them. What are your thoughts on abortion?
Well, my thoughts on abortion are that I oppose late-term abortion. And for me, abortion should be the very last alternative that anyone considers. But I also think it's a personal decision. It's between a woman and her doctor.
Mm-hmm. So it can should continue as is right now.
Should continue as it is. Like I say, I think from the standpoint of late-term abortion, that we need to look at that and make sure that that is in place.
The House would not vote on a Supreme Court justice, but if you were in the Senate, how would you have voted on Brett Kavanaugh?
Well, let me say, I was so frustrated by the system, simply backing that up. This information should have come out on Kavanaugh early on, and then it could have been a healthy debate that went on for a couple weeks. This dropping that in the bottom of the ninth inning, that's just not good policy for anyone.
Well, I want to thank you. Denny Wolf is the Democratic candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 9th Congressional District. It includes Lebanon, Schuylkill, Columbia, and parts of Berks, Carbon, Northumberland, Luzerne, and Montour counties. We have about 30 seconds left. If you could leave a message for voters, what would it be?
Sure. Well, look, I'm looking to run for Congress because I don't necessarily want to be a member of Congress. I want to represent the people of the 9th Congressional District. The people that I've talked to are anxious and eager to have someone represent them that knows what it's like to work for a living and represent middle-class America. And that's exactly what the 9th Congressional District is, and I look forward to representing them.
Well, thank you very much for being with us, Denny Wolf. By the way, I want to correct a mistake that was made a little bit earlier in the program. I talked about the documentary called Generations Yet to Come, Environmental Rights in Pennsylvania, 8 p.m. Thursday, October 25th. The documentary is about Senator Franklin Curry. So I wanted to correct that error. That is coming up on the 25th of October. We will talk to you tomorrow.